Thank you. Sorry, this is sort of rather a postmodern presentation in that I never use PowerPoint. If you feel withdrawal symptoms, please feel free to imagine the points that I make on the screen. And I don't even seem to have a title, but in effect, the title is Will Africa Be Able to Harness the Opportunity Presented by Natural Resources? Even before the rising commodity prices, Africa was very heavily dependent on natural resources. They dominated its export earnings. The last decade, you saw a rise in, massive rise in global commodity prices, which directly raised revenues and stimulated growth. But it also triggered a lot of discoveries. So the last decade was the decade of discoveries, and the coming decade is the decade of extraction. So the new discoveries will be coming on stream. The sheer scale of the revenues is enormous relative to aid, for example. It's just an order of magnitude bigger. This is Africa's own money. It's its one opportunity with its own money to develop. But it's a one-shot game. You take the natural resources out of the ground, and that's it. And so what I'm going to be posing is will that opportunity be harnessed? And it's going to be a long march, but I haven't got much time. So the structure of the march will be, first we'll march through the economic decision chain. What economic decisions have to go right? And it's quite a long decision chain. Then we'll turn to the political economy. Why are these decisions politically hard? Why do they tend often to go wrong? And then finally, I'm going to end on culture, because in the end, I'm going to argue that what a critical step is going to be changing beliefs, and what are the instruments, the policy instruments, by which beliefs get changed. Just to sort of motivate the whole thing, why do policy choices matter here? And this is a bit simple, but let's take Africa's. We'll take two African countries which, 40 years ago, were dirt poor, and they both found the same natural resource, and the resource was diamonds. And both countries, small and dirt poor, the only difference between them, one was not only dirt poor, but it was landlocked and pretty well a desert. And the other was dirt poor, but it had a marvelous fertile coastal position. So you start with that, you add diamonds, and one of them becomes the fastest growing country in the world, now highest per capita income in sub-Saharan Africa. The other goes to the bottom of the Global Human Development Index. Right, so dramatic divergence. And just to add irony, it's the landlocked desert that goes up and the wonderful fertile coastal position that goes down. So it's Botswana and Sierra Leone, of course. What developed Botswana was not diamonds, it was good policy. Now, I don't think you can find as dramatic a divergence in outcomes in any other field of economic policy. I mean, let me contrast that with, say, industrial policy, where Danny's, written a ton on industrial policy, and of course it matters, but let me take two countries which had very, very opposite industrial policies, Hong Kong and Singapore. Hong Kong, what was industrial policy? Do nothing at all. Right? It was British civil servants, do nothing. Singapore, active, right? What happens? Well, they both do very well, right? So that's not to say industrial policy doesn't matter. Of course it matters, right? But it's just to say, if we calibrate in terms of divergence, if there's one economic policy you've got to get right, it's natural resources. It's just hugely, outcomes are hugely sensitive to policy choices. With that, let me get started on the economic decision chain. And the first step in the chain is discover your natural resources. Let me tell you a little bit about natural resource discovery in Africa. For this, we really need two squares. Just imagine two squares, right? One is the typical square kilometer of the OECD, and the other is the typical square kilometer of Africa. Right? And I'm going to give you the figures as of the year 2000, and we're going to look underneath those two squares. Right? And underneath the typical square kilometer of the OECD, there were $125,000 worth of subsoil assets, natural assets. Right? So $125,000 under the typical square kilometer of the OECD. Now we're going to look under the typical square kilometer of Africa. Right? And to make it more fun, at least for me, instead of me telling you, you'll tell me. And to make it manageable, I'll give you a choice. Right? But you have to vote. Right? So the choice is that square kilometre of Africa, it could be less than the OECD, and it could be more than the OECD. Right? And you're going to vote now. So everybody who thinks that square kilometre of Africa was less than the OECD, hands up now. And everybody who thinks it was more, hands up now. That's very impressive. That's by far the best ever. It's only about 70% wrong. I've asked about 20,000 people this over the course of the last 3 or 4 years, and it's running 98% wrong. Right? The wrong answer is to say Africa had more. Right? As of the millennium, the right answer was about $25,000, a fifth. Right? There's only one guy who got it right, but he got the right answer to the wrong question. And this was Roger Myerson, Nobel laureate in economics. He just shouted out, "Paul, they must be the same, mustn't they?" And this was because what he'd worked out was what determines underneath there, locally random geological processes over big areas, means must be the same. That's the right answer to the wrong question. It's the answer to the question, what's really underneath there? Right? I tried to find out what was really underneath there on Google, but, you know, all I could find out was known subsoil assets. It just couldn't find out unknown subsoil assets, right? So, obviously, the figures I've given you were for what was discovered. Roger Myerson's right. Probably the average is the same. In fact, probably a bit higher for Africa, but because the OECD's been digging the stuff out for 200 years, right? Now, what that tells you is, as of the millennium, Africa had only discovered about a fifth of what's down there. Right? Two conclusions from that. One is, there's a lot to go. That's why there was so much discovery there in the last decade. The resource companies knew where to go and look. But the more important inference from this is that something clearly went very badly wrong with the discovery process in Africa, if only a fifth as much had been found. Right? So, what's gone wrong? Well, discovering natural resources is a classic bit of the economics of information. And what do we know from our Nobel laureates in economics of information? That the market in information doesn't work very well. Information is a public good. Now, you can turn it into a private good. If you do that, you lose all sorts of benefits. But ideally, since it's a public good, you should have public investment in geological information. Very, very few African countries did that. They've still not done it. But when I go and advise countries, that's the first thing I suggest is spend a few million dollars getting public geological information. The evidence from around the world is that the payoff to public geological information is very, very high. If you leave it to the market, what you tend to get is something like the economics of a gold rush. That is, for many years, nobody looks. It's a waiting game. Then somebody finds something, and then you move from too little investment in information to too much. So public geological information. If instead you privatize, you say, okay, you go look, whatever you find is yours. That gets you, first you lose all the benefits of public geological information, but you get yourself into a time consistency problem. Because if there's no geological information, the chances of you finding anything when you drill any one hole is very low. So you've got a 1 in 100 chance of finding a $1 billion oil well. So what's it worth? Not very much. See, so the prospecting rights are not worth very much. You pay your $10 million or whatever. And then either you don't find anything, well, you've lost your $10 million, or you find it. You've paid $10 million, it's worth $1 billion. And then is the government actually going to honour that deal? Of course not. The company can work that out. That's the time consistency problem. And so you don't invest in search. That's the bind that Africa was in. That's why it's either public geological information or not very much at all. So much for the discovery process. I'm going to have to move fast because there's a lot of different parts. Once you've discovered your natural assets, then the next challenge is to tax them. Because the natural resources you discover have got rents. Resource extraction companies are the agents for taking the rents out of the ground, but the rents shouldn't belong to the resource extraction companies. But they control them. Way to think of it is they are the custodians of other people's assets. They're entitled to the return of capital and risk and all the rest of it, but the rents should accrue to citizens. And the instrument for getting the rents is taxation. And here you get major problems, because the fundamental problem I'll signal here is asymmetry of information. Very severe asymmetry of information between companies and governments, especially tax authorities in poor countries. I remember talking with the tax authority in Zambia. What's Zambia got is copper, right? So the copper mines. And the tax authorities rather disarmingly said, well, of course, in Zambia there actually aren't very many good accountants. And they all work for the copper companies. And that's obviously endogenous. If the revenue authority happens to be able to recruit a good one, then they're bid away by the copper companies. What's their job in the copper companies? Their job in the copper companies is to report profits in such a way as to minimize taxability. What do you do about that? There is no perfect design tax system which gets the rents, other than in the context of the capacity of the country to collect them. And so the basic principle that I always advise is tax what you can observe, and if you're going to tax it, build the capacity to observe it. So the tax system has to be designed in cognizance of what you are capable of observing. For years, the IMF didn't do that. They do that now. But for a long time, they were basically operating on a model where they ignored the asymmetry of information problem, because they're used to operating with a textbook environment where that basically didn't exist. There's one further problem with taxation that I should discuss, and that is, as well as the information problem, there's what we coyly call the agency problem, which is that it's ridiculously easy for a crooked company to bribe the one or two officials that it's got to negotiate with to come up with a deal that's good for the country, good for the official, and bad for the country. And what can be done about that? Partly transparency, partly structured competition. I was advised trying to get a mining code to shrink the area of negotiation. Legislate, don't negotiate. And to the wherever possible, have structured competition through auctions. Of course, we know auctions are complicated, and so there's a whole layer of auction complexity that I've just not got time to go into, but which really matters. Moving along the economic decision chain, so we've found our resources, we've taxed them, and the next thing we've got to do is recognise that resources are always going to come out of the country somewhere, not everywhere. Resources are resource extraction is a physical process that happens in a particular location. And so people live in that location, and that generates a lot of potential problems and opportunities. The obvious problem, and the iconic case of a localized problem is the Niger Delta, where the initial story was there was environmental costs of extraction, which were not met. People took the law into their own hands, the only way they could, violence. And then they discovered that the oil companies would respond financially to violence, even though they wouldn't respond otherwise. And then it's but a small step to realize that you don't even need the environmental damage in order to do the violence. And so you get the emergence of a business of extortion, which has become really big business, very big business. And because it's got big business, the politicians have sort of come in. So this is now at the heart of the country, a very big extortion business. What's the solution to that? You have to get a mechanism for addressing and minimizing the environmental damage. If I just contrast oil spills in two gulfs, the Gulf of Mexico and the Gulf of Guinea, the oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico, BP, the first thing that BP did was to announce that it was going to spend $500 million, not on compensation, but on independent studies to work out who had suffered what damage. Because BP very rapidly worked out that given the legal context, the American legal system, the very best they could hope for was the truth. And so $500 million to try and get some evidence on the truth was money well spent. Has anybody spent $500 million on finding out who suffered from oil spills in the Gulf of Guinea? No. Right? Now, I am not advocating that the American legal system should be imported into the Gulf of Guinea. I wouldn't do that to anybody, right? But you clearly need to establish some practical mechanism, which, and credible mechanism, which actually gets compensation to people. One thing that calms things down, and the other is it provides an incentive for the company to avoid unnecessary, avoidable spills. That's one side of dealing with the local. A second aspect of dealing with the local is try and get some economic benefits. And the conventional approach has been, companies are very keen on this because companies have to operate in these environments. And the conventional approach has been CSR, corporate social responsibility, which is let's build a school, let's build a clinic, let's pretend we're a charity. And that really hasn't worked very well at all. It sends precisely the wrong signals. It sends the signals, we've got money to burn as long as you cause enough trouble. And it also inserts the company in the one role which the government absolutely, irreducibly should be performing itself. If it's not doing health and education, what on earth is it doing to establish its legitimacy? So what can companies do that actually spread the benefits? My own thing I favour is shared infrastructure. Mines need quite a lot of infrastructure. For example, they usually need railways to get the whatever it is they're digging out to the coast. They invariably need electricity and water. If they plan it in advance, they can design these things so as to serve the locality. Indeed, the rail can be designed so as to be multi-user and multi-function. The main thing I've been doing the last 3 years is advising the government of Guinea on the Simandou project, which is the biggest single mining operation in Africa, and indeed in the world. And the starting point of we were dealing with a perfectly decent company, but the starting point of the company was that the railway had to be dedicated use. It could only be used for iron ore, and it could only be used by the company. You could see why it took both those positions. Technologically, it was cheaper just to move the iron ore. And in terms of not allowing other companies access, once you got that rail line, you'd basically got a monopoly on all future resource discoveries in that country. And so the centerpiece of the negotiation with the company was to get it away from those positions. And that's what was achieved. So that railway is now being designed as multi-user, multi-function. There's a lot of scope in electricity across Africa. The continent is desperately short of electricity, especially in rural areas. So by installing more electricity than the mine or whatever it is needs, you can actually give the locality a real material benefit. That's dealing with the local. Now let's march to the sort of big-time economics. So we've discovered the stuff, we've taxed it, we've avoided our Niger Delta, we've got the revenues coming in. What do we do with the revenues? The next key decision is what's the right balance between consumption and assets. And until recently, this was, again, a almost comically polarized position between governments and the IMF. So the IMF had just, the textbook model it was using was permanent income hypothesis. And so it was recommending all revenues should go into assets and you just can consume the income stream from the assets. It was also, because the IMF is instinctively conservative, it said, we've no idea how much revenue will come in. So we recommend the bird in the hand rule, which is to say the only revenues you've got are the ones that are already accrued. So all the revenue from resource extraction goes into a fund, and only as the fund builds can you then consume the income from the fund. That was allied, and it was literally a fund held abroad, because that was allied with the diagnosis of severe limits on absorptive capacity, so that you couldn't absorb this locally. So that was the position until 3 or 4 years ago, basically. And that's now changed. Meanwhile, of course, no poor African government did anything remotely like that, at least not for more than a couple of years. Chad established a fund. More recently, Ghana established a fund, a heritage fund. Absolutely no prospect whatsoever of these lasting. What's shifted is, first of all, the economic theories moved on, so that we now recognize that the permanent income theory just isn't the right model for African-style conditions. If you're a poor country that is gradually converging onto world income levels, then the right concept is not how should I use these revenues, these depleting natural assets, so as permanently to raise consumption. Suppose you're Guinea with your, in fact, let's be Ghana with oil. 20 years of oil. Do you really want to use your oil in such a way that you add the same increment to consumption in the next few years and in the 22nd century? Huh? The 22nd century doesn't matter. By the 22nd century, you'll have converged. Right? So the permanent income approach gives you the right answer to the wrong question. And the right issue is, how can I accelerate my convergence path? So not add to consumption forever, but add to consumption quite probably beyond the horizon of the exhaustion of the resource, but not forever. Right? What that tells you is you'll still need a pretty high savings rate, a pretty high flow into assets, but not as high as permanent income suggests. It's perfectly appropriate to put, you know, maybe 30, maybe 50% into consumption. So that's savings versus consumption. And now, what assets? And again, the IMF until very recently, the model was save it abroad because of absorptive capacity limits. And there was a glamorous model out there, not Angelina Jolie, but Norway. And what Norway does is a sovereign wealth fund. And so I just gave an address to the Association of the Global Association of Sovereign Wealth Funds. And the head of this association said, you know, our fastest growing membership in the world is from Africa. So many African countries are now setting up sovereign wealth funds. Right? It's the thing to do. Norway, Governor Norway has been asked by 50 developing countries for advice on setting up the Norwegian model. Right? And that's a tragedy because what Norway does is very sensible for Norway and would be completely ridiculous for the typical poor country. Norway established the sovereign wealth fund when it already had more invested capital per member of the labour force than any other country on earth. And that is literally true. The countries that I work on have less invested capital per member of the labour force than any other countries in the world. And so their priority clearly should be to build their domestic capital base, not acquire capital abroad. It makes sense for Norway to build up capital in Brazil and China. It doesn't make sense for Guinea and Ghana to do so. But the IMF was completely right to say there are limits on absorptive capacity, severe limits. Where it was wrong was saying because there are severe limits, the right thing to do is to put all the money abroad. There are severe limits on absorptive capacity, and so the right thing to do is gradually to break them, is gradually to raise absorptive capacity. If you think about it for a moment, that's evident. If the country doesn't develop the capacity to absorb more money for productive investment, it cannot develop. And so there's no choice but to build the capacity to invest well. And I call that process investing in investing, building the capacity to invest well. And there's a range of components in that. It's partly build the capacity to do good public investment. Selection, design, implementation, evaluation. It's partly the capacity to build private investment. So investing in investing is the precursor to how you've got to use the money. Anything about which sectors to invest in? The fashionable thing to do if you go and talk with governments in poor countries is they want to add value to the natural resources they extract. And if you think about it for a moment, that's about the last thing they should be doing. Because adding value to the resources you extract is shifting your economy to make it yet more dependent upon a single sector, which is already very volatile, and a sector where you're gradually depleting. You know, you can predict with absolute certainty that in 30 years' time, Ghana won't have any oil. So there's not much point in building an oil refinery there and that sort of thing. A way to think about it is that what you need to be investing in is generic platforms off which you will be able to diversify the economy into other exports once the natural resources are starting to dwindle. And what are those generic platforms? Well, we don't know what the opportunities of the 2030s and 2040s will be, but a decent guess is that they'll need human capital and they'll need efficient cities. So if you had to invest in anything, it would be these two sort of non-tradables, human capital and efficient cities. You need institutions to smooth volatility, and I won't go into that, but it's sort of blinding the obvious. That's the thing that Chile's managed to do. The sequence of economic policy, any finance minister in Africa with natural resources, I tell you, you'd have on your dashboard three policy clocks. And one is the slow tick of resource depletion. You've got to build up assets to offset resource depletion. A second is the erratic tick of commodity prices. You've got to ride the tiger of commodity prices. That's the smoothing role. And the third slow tick is gradually building the capacity to invest well, the investing and investing agenda. Until you've done that, you park the money abroad. As you've built that capacity, you bring it back home. So there's the economic decision chain. And unfortunately, very often that goes wrong. And there are systematic reasons why it goes wrong. First, the natural resources may lead the state to deteriorate. If we use the Acemoglu and Robinson criteria of a centralized and inclusive state, natural resource discoveries can make the state less centralized. By centralized, they just mean a monopoly of power, a monopoly of violence. And very obviously, natural resource discoveries can make it much easier to have private military power, because natural resources provide you the finance to run rebel armies and the incentive to do so. So they can make it less centralized. They can also make the state less inclusive. Very obvious point here is that if we start from what makes a state inclusive, it's that pressure that comes from the need to tax. No taxation without representation. Natural resource revenues get you off the hook of needing to tax the population. They're sort of, if aid has this problem, natural resources have this problem 10 times over. The state will also deteriorate because the agency problems become more acute. There's a honeypot to be controlled, and so you get a selection effect in politics. Crooks have bigger incentive to try and enter the political process, and of course corruption is more tempting. So that's the state deteriorating. But we should also recognize that the decision chain I've been through is unusually difficult politically. It's very long term. Offsetting resource depletion requires you to think a generation. The typical OECD government, what is its average horizon? 2 years to the next election, 2.5 years. The amazing thing is that given the economic structures of the OECD, we can actually get away with such a short-term horizon. You know, the triumph of public policy the last century has been the integrated annual budget. We have very good resource allocation across sectors within an annual budget. And that seems to be pretty well good enough. The IMF's been trying to get medium-term financial programs for ages, and it's taken root basically nowhere. Right? But we're talking about a view of a generation. Not only that, but the decision chain are interdependent. If one part of that decision chain goes wrong, it weakens the incentive to do other aspects of the decision chain. I was just earlier this week talking with a guy who'd been in the previous cabinet in Ghana, and he said, we took the view, we knew that there was a case for being prudent, but in cabinet we actually said, well, we're quite likely to lose power at the next election. If we save, we're just handing it to the next guys. And so let's spend it now. Right? Not only let's spend it now, let's go and borrow. And finally, there's complexity. There's a need for the technocratic in societies which have very little technocratic capacity. The consequence is failure. And I've got my own research on this. Other people have got their research on this. You're going to have to take it as read, that the consequence is usually... There are more Sierra Leone stories than there are Botswana stories. So finally, let me come to some solutions. And I'm going to go through three solutions. One is rules. You need, in order to get these decisions implemented, you need rules. You need rather specific rules tailored to the natural resource extraction problem. Why do you need rules? Because you'll be taking the same decision again and again. And rules provide both guidance to decision takers and, if the decision taker chooses not to follow the rule, that creates information. It has to then provide some sort of justification. On top of rules, you need what I usually call institutions, but maybe I better call them organization, because Acemoglu and Robinson seem to just conflate rules and institutions as if they're the same thing. What I mean by an institution, in contrast to rules are just that. They're words on paper. Institutions, for me, are teams of people with a mandate and the skills to implement the rules. And what poor countries are most short of is effective organisations that can do things, especially in the public sector. Right? They need the mandate, they need the individual skills. Most of all, they need to go through the internalisation process, the sort of Akerlof process of the leap of identity that says we are a team who identifies with this objective. And so there's a range of institutions that are all along that decision chain that are needed, that have to be built. But rules and institutions by themselves are not enough. They'll just get ignored. Right? And you'll forgive me, Francois, but as a Brit, I cannot resist the example of the euro as an example of two fiscal rules and one institution and 17 fine upstanding European governments and 12 years to follow the rules. How many of those 17 governments have followed those two rules for 12 years? Anybody know, incidentally? The answer is one, Finland, which is why they're so cross. In other words, what the rules and institutions only get followed if you've got citizens who believe in them. You actually have to build a critical mass of citizens who believe in the rules and the institutions. And the hardest thing is actually building that critical mass of citizen understanding. And have I got 2 minutes?
Two.
Yeah. Let me close with three aspects of beliefs, citizen beliefs, that are vital to build. One is ownership. Who owns the natural resources in the country? They're discovered here, not everywhere. Yeah. And if you're not careful, you end up with Scotland, as it were. It's ours. Yeah. Tanzania discovered offshore gas a couple of years ago. They've already had riots and four dead in the region that's onshore from the gas. Mtwara is saying, it's ours. Yeah. How can you avoid that? The first president of Botswana Sir Seretse Khama, very cleverly, very astutely, how did he handle diamonds? When they knew they were going to prospect, he went round all the clan chiefs with the following narrative. He said, "We are dirt poor. We might have diamonds. There's diamonds in other countries around us. Can we agree that whatever we find, wherever we find it, belongs to all of us?" Done ex ante. Of course, it was easy for the clan chiefs to say, yeah, that's the best arrangement we can do. And so in Botswana, ownership has never been an issue because the government built that narrative of common ownership before the resources were discovered. Elsewhere, leadership hasn't taken that trouble. So ownership is, and the nightmare, if you don't do it, is violence, because people very rapidly come to actually believe that it's theirs. There's great work in social psychology, Jonathan Haidt, The Righteous Mind. Right? People bend their sense of self-righteousness to their own advantage. It's a psychological bias. So ownership, expectations. What happened in Liberia? Exxon comes in to look for oil, $50 million signature bonus. What's the chances of Liberia finding oil? About 1 in 10. Right? $50 million. It sounds huge. The British government, the Blair's government, discovered that the British population couldn't tell the difference between 50 million and 50 billion and 50 trillion. Right? So, and of course people can't, because they don't usually operate in those terms. In Liberia, $50 million, you know, it just means it means we're rich. Yeah? How do you counter that? Because if you don't counter it, not only do you get an explosion of expectations, but very rapidly people say, we know we're rich, but we don't feel rich. So where is it? You, the government, are crooks. Huh? How do you counter that? Very simple. Right? You just report the thing per capita in local currency. What Liberians had actually got was it was $12 per person. And that was probably all they were going to get. Were they rich? Didn't need to work anymore? With $12, no. Right? But nobody put that information to them. I suggested that in Ghana earlier in the week. I suggested it to the three economic committees of Parliament and to the President. The President at least had the decency to get out his calculator and try and work the number out. Right? Nobody knows. They can tell me how many billion barrels they've got, but they can't tell me what it means per person. Insane. So ownership, expectations, and finally stewardship. The idea that you shouldn't just spend it all on consumption now, you shouldn't borrow to spend, which is what's happening in both Ghana and Zambia, sovereign bond issues to finance public sector wage increases. Now, the myth is that poor people will not be prudent, cannot be persuaded to be prudent. And that's obviously false, because most poor people have children and they're concerned about the future. A narrative which says we're going to use this to make our children's future better than our own is entirely possible. It's governments that don't have children, not people. Anyway, on that note, thank you very much.